Hello, everybody, and welcome to another amazing episode of the Kenyan Wall Street Podcast. As usual, I am your host, Prince Muragori. I'm the resident economist here at the Kenyan Wall Street. And today, I am happy to be joined by a team of two economists. So best believe you're going to talk about issues macro from some of the best players in the game. And these two economists are from Renaissance Capital. As you might know, earlier this month, on the 9th and 10th of September, Renaissance Capital held the 6th annual East Africa Investor Conference. And it was a very, very insightful discussion for those who might have had a chance to look at it. If not, you can always visit the website. And on the first day, there was a panel discussion, which was a macro panel involving these two economists. And I shall introduce the two economists. First off, we have Mr. Charlie Robertson. And Charlie is an economist with RenCap, Renaissance Capital. He is the global economist there and very, very well versed with matters, emerging markets, macro and geopolitical issues. And that's Charles for you. I'm sure many of you might have seen him on Twitter. He shares a lot of good insights, good chats, and we're going to definitely hear a lot from him. So Charles, the Global Chief Economist at Renaissance Capital, how are you? Can you hear me?
I'm very good. And just for any of your listeners who haven't had a chance to see your profile picture, you in a dinner jacket looking extremely smart and very cool, I have to say.
Thank you very much, Charles. Thank you. And we're definitely very excited for this one. You know, we don't usually have as many economists as we would hope. And so we're definitely happy to have you on board. And next up, we have Yvonne Mhango, who is the Sub-Saharan Africa economist and head of research of Sub-Saharan Africa at Renaissance Capital. Yvonne, how are you doing?
I'm very well, thanks. And I'm very excited to be on your podcast today. And hello to your listeners.
Okay, very well. So, guys, as you know, this is an interesting time to be having a discussion with economists because 2020 is definitely one of those years where there is a lot to talk about. And Charles, I'd like to pose my first question to you. As you know, it being the COVID-19 pandemic year, we have to sort of kick off our discussion based on that. And As most people know, that this COVID-19 shock has not been the usual one-sided or one market side shock. It has been a multifaceted shock. You know, it affected the demand side, the supply side, even the financial sector side. And many countries have seen historic declines in GDP growth, particularly Western economies. However, when we look at Africa, we see that the data indicates that African countries haven't been as badly hit by the COVID shock compared to other countries, which is a big, big relief for the continent. And Charles, I'd like you to talk about why is this the case, that Africa sort of has proved a bit more resilient? And what does this mean for Africa's economic competitiveness in the new decade? Over to you, Charles.
I think we took our first positive take on the virus back in February, March, when the Chinese data for the first 1,000 deaths showed what age people were tending to die in high numbers from COVID. And it was really painful for anybody over the age of 80. Mm-hmm. And with the half as deadly if you were aged 70 to 80, and less than half as deadly again if you were aged 60 to 70. And we did a quick demographic check of the world, and we found that the vulnerable population was the lowest in the world in Africa because of the youth of the continent. The numbers of people who were over 80 years old in countries like Nigeria and Kenya, and it was, when we rounded it to the nearest whole number, is 0%. So that told us that we were not likely to get a significant number of deaths. relative to developed markets. And that has meant that we haven't had to have the long, severe lockdowns that so much of Europe or some states in the US have had to do in order to keep the virus under control, because the virus wasn't such a threat. And we've begun to see that in the data. So Yvonne did a piece the other day about Nigeria's GDP dropping about 6%, I think it was, in the second quarter. We've seen figures double that, three times that in Western economies. And Western economies not only are older, but also much more sensitive to a hit to retail, to tourism, to leisure, all of these areas where are much more significant parts of the economy. And therefore, the hit to those sectors has really, really hurt. Again, there's a much greater dependency on, say, agriculture, which might be 2% of GDP in the UK, but could be 20, 25% of GDP in sub-Saharan countries. And agriculture just doesn't, you know, the crops still grow, even if the virus is happening. So it just, that's also helped. And so what I think is so important about this is that when we had the global financial crisis back in 2008-09, what was really striking to investors globally was that frontier markets, African markets, South Asian markets, managed to get through the crisis with much less pain than it is because they weren't so dependent on the banking system and on all the leverage that really hit the West in the 2008-09 crisis. But they got through that crisis with less pain, and hopefully they're going to get through this crisis with less pain. And then I'm hoping the global investors in the 2020s will look back and say, well, who outperformed? Which economies should I be investing in, which don't get whacked in the same way that everybody else does when we get a global recession? And I'm hoping they'll put more money to work in Africa, and we'll see faster growth in Africa as a result of that.
Okay, thank you. And just to follow up on that issue, Yvonne, Renaissance Capital created a ranking, a sort of a composite resilience score ranking that, you know, it looked at how swiftly a country is likely to recover from the COVID-19 shock. And it looked at, you know, key sectors of the local economy, such as agriculture, tourism, global trade, and how these are insulated from the global economies. And then it also looked at the size of buffers, government and household buffers, such as budget balance, public debt and GDP per growth. And what's interesting is that for the African countries that were ranked, for the sub-Saharan African countries, among the top five were three East African countries. We had Ethiopia, Tanzania, and Rwanda. And so we saw East African countries performing exceptionally well. And my question to you would be, what unique capabilities enable the East African countries to be more resilient compared to other countries in the continent? And subsequently, what does this mean for the East African community's economic competitiveness in the new decade? Over to you, Yvonne.
Thanks, Prince. Yes, so early in the year, we established what we called a resilience score for our countries in sub-Saharan Africa. And we basically looked at the resilience under according to two main indicators or broad indicators. So under one umbrella, we had indicators that reflected how insulated those economies were from the rest of the economy. Basically, the argument being that the more insulated they were, the less exposed they were to global dynamics, the more protected they would be and the less hit they'll be by the crisis. The other broad umbrella of indicators was the buffers that these countries had, and this was both on the government side as well as on the household front. Now, East Africa scored particularly well because of its sizable agriculture sector. And that was an indicator that fell under the broad umbrella of how insulated they are from the global economy. And the argument there is that if you have a sizable agriculture sector, given the nature of agriculture, particularly in our part of the world, it wouldn't be as impacted by the crisis because it tends to occur in outlying areas in the countryside. There's less congestion there, so less chance of catching the virus. And also, aside from the cash crops that are grown on the continent, most of what is grown in our part of the world is for domestic consumption and in a lot of cases subsistence. So that shouldn't be impacted by a fall in global demand. Now, East Africa, as you rightly know, has a large agriculture sector. So in our view, as long as agriculture grew, as long as there's rainfall, you would see the economy grow, as we saw in the first quarter of this year for Kenya. And we're expecting a similar performance in the rest of the year for Kenya. The other reason why East Africa fared pretty well, in case of Tanzania in particular, is because it does have buffers on the fiscal side. And by that, I mean a relatively small budget deficit, which implies and also a relatively low debt position, which implies that the country has room to provide some sort of fiscal stimulus. And that's helped it score pretty well. And just generally across East Africa, you find that the economies are diversified, both on the export side as well as on the GDP front, which helps provide some impetus, and you don't have one dominant sector dragging down growth. All of that said, though, what's been interesting was recently, as you know, in the past weekend, Rwanda has published its GDP numbers, and there was a rather deep contraction in the economy of around 12%. And I think what that's suggesting to us, if you recall, just to give background, Rwanda is one of the countries we expected to do better. But what these numbers are telling us is that a stringent lockdown would override a lot of the factors that I've mentioned. And as you're probably aware, Rwanda is probably one of two countries that imposed a very stringent lockdown this year, the other being South Africa. And you are seeing that in the double-digit decline in the case of Rwanda.
Okay. Thanks for that. Very well covered around the issues of COVID and subsequent implications for the continent and specifically East Africa. Now let's switch the discussion up a little bit. Let's talk about financial assets, particularly bonds. Now, Charlie, this is for you, Charles, and you know that the new decade is going to be very interesting for bond market. Very interesting indeed. Because we're likely to see a sort of continuation of falling of the yields of the long-term bonds in Western countries like US, Germany, and many others. And as such, we are likely to see many international investors opting to put their money in African bonds, which have consistently posted higher yields. So this means that African countries will have capacity to borrow further. But Charles, what does this mean for African government debt? And, you know, particularly what sort of borrowing arrangements should African governments negotiate for in order to ensure utility maximization in this situation?
Yeah, the key point, as you said, was that we've got extremely low yields now in the West, down at around 0%, I guess, if you averaged out Germany, UK, US, France, and so on. And there is this desire for yield that people have always thought they should have something in bonds because that was the safe place to be. But when you get no yield on that at all, it's not as attractive for investors. So they're going into equities, and we've seen that in the US stock market since March. But they're also been putting their money into US corporate bonds, and there's starting to be a flow back into emerging market bonds. I think it's going to get much bigger if Biden wins the election in the US. I think it's going to get much, much bigger. And people will then be saying, where can I get yield? And high single digits are still available from a number of African credits. The advantage of that is twofold. Firstly, you know, if countries do not increase their borrowing, then their borrowing costs, the interest payments they make on that borrowing, is going to be much less. So governments will have more, can save a bit of money, reduce their budget deficits if they wish. But I think more likely is the government's going to take advantage of this cheaper funding from the West and try and grow faster. So it's a matter of choosing the right investment projects, prioritizing, you know, the essentials, which, you know, from what we can see, education is absolutely essential to help a country industrialize. The next essential is electricity. But, you know, electricity has been quite expensive in East Africa because the borrowing costs to pay for that electricity have been quite expensive. But if the borrowing costs to roll out new electricity gets cheaper, then hopefully the electricity gets cheaper, and then factories can start coming to Kenya and others in the region and starting to manufacture. I think the education numbers in East Africa are already pretty good. So governments need to be making sure they're investing in the right infrastructure, and also just making sure their yield curve is not too lumpy. You don't want to have, you know, $10 billion worth of bonds all maturing, coming due in 2025. You want to spread it out, make sure there's something coming due in 2024, maybe a bit more a couple of years later, a bit more a couple of years later. Don't have it all bunched up, because you don't want to be in a position 5 years down the line where there's some global recession hitting again and no one wants to lend to anyone during the midst of a crisis, and then you owe a load of cash back. You want to spread out your debt profile and try and perhaps restructure or pay back perhaps some of the more expensive bonds that have been issued in the past, and take advantage of these lower interest rates. So there's quite a few things that I think governments could be making sure they do. Invest in the right way. Don't bunch up repayments in a few years' time to all come at the same time. And perhaps repay some bonds early and use the lower interest rates to lock in that lower cost.
Yeah, I definitely like what you talked about, you know, investments in education, because that would be the key for us to improve our industrialization process, to grow manufacturing, because as Yvonne had mentioned, you know, agriculture is a huge component of African countries' GDPs, particularly East African countries. And we sort of saw a jump from agriculture-based economies to sort of service-based without a lot of emphasis on industrialization manufacturing in the past decades. But for sure, if we're able to get that right this decade, it's definitely going to be a good move for the future. So Yvonne, let me engage you on the topic about GDP growth. So Renaissance Capital forecasts Kenya's GDP to grow at 1.5%. We definitely have seen very many forecasts this year. Some of them very, very conservative, including those of the IMF. Could you please give some comments as to the rationale behind this forecast of 1.5% and what sort of underlying assumptions needs to hold for this work?
Okay, thanks. So our main assumption around that is that agriculture would grow this year. And I think the first quarter growth numbers were pretty encouraging in that regard. We saw 4.9% growth for the economy. And the biggest driver of that was agriculture, as you know, due to good rains. There'd been a lot of concern, as you probably, you're closer to it, so you're probably more aware about what the locust swarms would mean for the agriculture sector. But first quarter results at least showed that they hadn't had a major impact negatively, that is, on the sector and by implication on growth. So our assumption is that the weather continues to be benign during the remainder of the year, and that agriculture continues to grow, and as it accounts for at least a fifth of GDP, it should help at least contribute to growth in that economy. And also from the second half of the year, as we've seen some easing of restrictions, pick up on services in particular, transport services resuming, and also industries that have been shut down, such as manufacturing, are now allowed to resume. That should also allow for growth to pick up in the subsequent quarters, or at least the second half of the year. We still have second quarter GDP number for Kenya coming out, I think, next week. That should give us some better indication on how or what the outturn will be for 2020. But for now, we are still expecting positive growth out of Kenya for this year.
Okay, thank you. Definitely looking forward to seeing how things unfold over the next coming number of months. For sure, a lot of clarity will be obtained, maybe perhaps later in the year or next year, when a breakthrough is made in terms of a vaccination and there is more resilience and sort of certainty in the economy. Moving on, and this question is meant for you, Charles. So we know that the capacity for African countries to use domestic borrowing to finance their sort of revenue obligations it remains low, particularly because there are very high interest rates in Africa. And part of the reason we have high interest rates on the continent is because we have low savings rates. A lot of economic theory of growth, you know, like the Solow Swan model, they all talk about how savings, as well as population growth, are fundamental determinants of economic growth. So please talk about how, you know, fertility rates in Africa and countries are an integral component of this issue of why we do have high domestic rates that make it very hard for African economies to self-finance domestically. Over to you, Charles.
Yeah, it's this is kind of novel research, I'm afraid, so it's a little bit controversial. But we've been wondering and bothered for years about the high domestic financing costs. And I've, from country to country, I've heard different explanations for why savings are why it's so costly to borrow money. So Yvonne and I have been in Zambia and Tanzania and asked them, why do the banks charge so much? And this was obviously in light of Kenya's interest rate cap. But we could see that there was a reason that the politicians pushed through that interest rate cap, even if it didn't lead to all the benefits they expected. And we go to some other countries, and then they feel it's the capitalists who control the mines, the gold mines, or the oil companies. They're the ones who are taking the wealth, and this is why there's a shortage of savings. But I found this fascinating paper out of China. To do with Chinese development a year or so ago. And it showed that over half of the growth in household savings could be directly attributed to a fall in the fertility rate. When the Chinese stopped having 5 or 6 kids per family, per woman in the 60s, when that fell to under 3 kids per woman at the end of the 70s, even before the one-child policy, Chinese savings started to dramatically increase. And I've spoken to a lot of people about this, and they say, well, it kind of makes sense. When you've got 6 kids, you haven't got much money left over for savings. In fact, your kids are your savings. They're the ones who are going to look after you in your future. But you don't have any cash left over at the end of the month or even the end of the week to put into the bank. And therefore, the bank hasn't got any cash to lend out to the companies to invest, or indeed to the government even. They will lend to the government, but it's going to be quite expensive because there's not much cash in the bank. When you start to have 2 to 3 kids per woman, then families save for the kids because the kids become an investment rather than their savings. And you want to send that kid to the best school they can go to, perhaps to university as well. So you need to save for that. And you start to save more money in the bank. And then the bank has a load of cash and that bank can lend it out cheaply. So you go to a country in Africa like Morocco or Mauritius, and what we have seen is that a fall in fertility rates has happened at the same time as a massive rise in savings rates. And governments in Mauritius and Morocco can borrow at 2% for a year. Companies can borrow not much more than that, 2% for a year. Now, you can't do that in high fertility countries. So what's really interesting to me now is to see which countries are we going to see that fertility rate drop below 3 in the next 10 to 15 years. And those countries are Egypt, Kenya, Ethiopia, and Ghana. And what I think that means is that interest rates should fall significantly in 10 to 15 years. And then governments can both borrow themselves more cheaply, companies can borrow more cheaply, and investment can be higher. And then you have this fantastic demographic dividend where there's not as many kids around. And as a result, more parents can go out to work, which means more people can work. And at the same time, savings in the banking system increase, which means interest rates come down. And it's a double demographic dividend. You've got more labor and cheaper capital at the same time. It's a fantastic combination. It's what's boomed East Asia in the way that it has done over the last 30 years. And it's happened in places like Morocco have done well. Mauritius has obviously done very well, helped by those same double demographic dividends. And I think it's coming Kenya's way in 10 years' time.
Yeah, well, it's definitely an elegant argument for sure. The issue of consumption smoothing, which is one of the key factors that enable a household to save. Consumption smoothing is easier if you have a smaller household for sure, because you can you have disposable income, and sort of the emphasis becomes on the quality over the quantity. And so definitely we are looking forward to what the new decade holds in terms of African countries. I know for sure Kenya had a very high fertility rate in the 70s, and this has gone down according to World Bank development indicators. It's really gone down. So let's see what the future holds. Of course, this is also a social debate. Maybe we shouldn't have had only economists. We should have called philosophers as well as other experts. But yeah, time shall tell. So Yvonne, I want to engage you at this stage and talk about Kenya's trade balance. So the COVID-19 period is interesting because, as I mentioned, it was a multifaceted shock. Things were getting in on this side, getting out on the other side. And so some sectors, for example, the Kenya trade balance, it remained fairly sort of stagnant without any increase or decrease on one specific side, because any fall in exports was kind of accompanied by a fall in imports. So Yvonne, how do you see the trade balance behaving? How do you see it playing out when the global economies resume to pre-COVID trade dynamics?
Okay, thanks for that. So let's take a step back to pre-COVID and see what trade balance looked like in Kenya. Mm. And Kenya's trade balance since around 2015 improved. And a big reason for that was the fall in the oil price. And that helped the current account narrow, if you recall, from the high single digits, so 8 to 9% of GDP, to around 4 to 5% of GDP, which was very positive for the external position of the country. However, our concern, even through that narrowing, which is a positive thing in itself, was that this did not reflect an actual improvement on the export side, which is what you want to see. It was actually due to the oil price coming off, which for us implied that Kenya would be at risk going forward if the oil price were to spike, because it implies that trade balance would deteriorate and your current account deficit return to the high levels that we had earlier in the past decade. Now, going forward, your question is what happens going forward? So as you rightly said, in this crisis, the oil price falling has allowed for imports to fall, which was a good thing because it implied that when you had this sharp decline in horticulture exports, the impact wasn't as severe on the trade balance and the current account because imports also fell off. So you had a much more moderate deterioration of your current account. Now going forward, if you look at the oil price projections, I think our house view is that the oil price will average around $50 per barrel next year. So it does imply that the oil price still remains relatively benign. We're not expecting any sharp increases or nothing close to what we had pre-2015. That's a good thing for Kenya because it implies that they'll be able to contain their trade balance. However, over the medium to long term, that is still something Kenya needs to be concerned about, in particular, improving its exports, because its export to GDP ratio is actually quite low and has been shrinking over the years from around the low teens to less than 10%. And that needs to improve if the country wants to remain competitive and also if it wants to keep from being vulnerable to changes in the oil price. Because at some point it will turn against Kenya. So in the meanwhile, it would be good to see if there were reforms or policies put in place to try and grow that export balance and improve it to levels that it was at a decade ago.
Okay. Thanks for that, Yvonne. And definitely when we begin the discussion about the trade balance, we start to talk about things like comparative advantage, some geopolitics. And on that topic of geopolitics, Charles, in what ways do you see the upcoming US presidential election playing into the Kenya shilling US dollar exchange rate? Charles?
Sorry about that. I think the election is going to be quite a big deal. And the reason for this, with reference to Africa, is that Donald Trump has been an effective president in terms of getting foreigners to invest more in the US. And an effective precedent in deterring US companies from investing abroad. And we've seen a net inflow to America of hundreds of billions of dollars of foreign direct investment in the last couple of years. And that's not normal. Normally, you'd expect richer countries to say, where can my company go and operate more cost effectively? We'll concentrate on the high value added in our domestic country, the UK, US, Germany, wherever, and we'll take advantage of this up and coming cheaper workforce that's better educated than ever in emerging markets. But that hasn't happened in the last 2 to 3 years under Trump. So I think what's going to happen, assuming Biden wins, and all US presidents who preside over a recession in their first term, they all lose. So there's a good chance of Biden winning. Assuming Biden wins, I think that policy of trying to get all the investment back into the States will change. I think US companies will start to look abroad again. And I think Europeans and others who've been putting factories into America because they're so scared of the tariffs that Trump could impose can start instead to put factories where they are actually make some more money on and which are more profitable for them. And I think that's going to be a dollar negative. So I suspect that will contribute to the US dollar being weaker. And that then in turn, along with the investment flows, starts to help out emerging markets. Because emerging markets, you know, when they see their currencies do relatively better against the dollar, they can sustain more dollar debt because it's a bit cheaper. They tend to do a little bit better on the terms of trade issues as well. So I think what we should see is more money coming into emerging markets, more portfolio investment, more foreign direct investment, and the weaker dollar, all contributing to a better few years for emerging and frontier markets, at least in 2020 to 2025. Beyond that, it depends on the next presidential election. We'll see.
Yeah, as any great economist would say, it depends. And for sure, I think another thing that will definitely be playing, we'll be moving things in that space, will be the Kenya-US Free Trade Agreement. We'll definitely see how that sort of plays out after the election. So maybe after this thing settled down, we'll definitely have a follow-up podcast and see how our discussion might pause. Yvonne, now that you've been speaking about the shilling, I know you really look at the Kenya shilling quite a lot, and I saw some Renaissance Capital currency analysis where the Kenya shilling specifically was seen to be trading further away from its fair value as compared to other East African currencies like, you know, the Ugandan shilling and the Tanzanian shilling. So what are the factors that were leading to this misplacement of the Kenya shilling? In terms of, you know, it's trading away from its fair value. And how do we see its valuation moving forward, Yvonne?
Okay. So why is the Kenyan shilling more misaligned than the other currencies in the region, including Uganda, Tanzania, and Rwandan currencies? Right. The main reason is because the shilling has not depreciated as much in nominal terms as those other currencies have. And typically what you want to see is a currency depreciating at least by its rate of inflation on an annual basis. And mm-hmm. because the shilling has remained, this is pre-COVID, has remained relatively stable despite what's happening with inflation, then you've seen it become a little bit more misaligned compared to its fair value. That's probably the main reason you see the Kenyan shilling turn out to be stronger than, say, the Rwandan franc and Tanzanian shilling, which tend to trade closer to their fair values. And in terms of our outlook, we don't expect, at least over the short term, much change. It does help Kenya that its inflation has been moderating, particularly during this crisis. That implies that its degree of misalignment falls, which is a good thing. So that helps the shilling story. But other than that, we do expect it to remain a little bit more misaligned relatively to the other currencies or relative to the shilling's own fair value. There's nothing to suggest in the horizon that that should change anytime soon.
Okay. Well, thanks for that, guys. And as we come to a close of the session, we definitely have to talk a bit about the sixth annual virtual East Africa Investor Conference, which was held by Renaissance Capital earlier this month, I think on the 9th and 10th of September. And both of you participated in a panel discussion session with the Deputy Governor of the Central Bank of Kenya, Sheila Mbijewe, as well as the IMF resident representative for Kenya, Mr. Tobias Rasmussen. So what were your biggest takeaways from this session, which you might want to share with our audience? And let's begin with you, Charles, and then we'll come to Yvonne. So over to you, Charles.
From my perspective, it's that growth, it's the growth expectation. It's kind of phenomenal that you look around the world, you've got China, Taiwan, that's it, able to grow in 2020. Maybe one or two others. Vietnam might manage it, possibly Korea. But I think people have focused a little bit on East Asia doing reasonably well. But everybody else sitting there in the US and Europe get very easily sucked into that idea that the whole world has just collapsed. The economy is dreadful everywhere. And it's really great to just hear a central banker say with credibility that we're going to be expecting growth this year. And to see the IMF also come alongside with that and say, hint that there'll be an upgrade in their forecasts coming out in the next month or so. So I think this is just, I think it's all part of our hope and belief that we're going to see Africa outperform, and that that investors will start to put some money behind that. It was a very well attended conference. And the only shame from our perspective is that we like to have the conference in Nairobi every year. That's where our office is. This is when we get everybody together in the right place and they see the country for themselves. It's a shame it had to be done online, but that is what it is. Hopefully next year it'll all be back to normal.
Well, yeah, definitely 2020 is a year of everything virtual, but it gives me joy to hear that the future is bright, and this is a good time to be in Africa. This is a good time to be in Kenya. So that's encouraging news. Yvonne, what were your biggest takeaways?
It won't differ much from Charlie. I think for me, the most positive takeaway from that session was the IMF saying that they would likely be revising up their growth projection for Kenya for 2020. As you know, they were predicting growth of negative 0.3%. I think out of the East African countries, it was only Kenya that they were expecting to see a decline in. It could actually turn out possibly that it's Rwanda that has a small decline. But anyway, our main takeaway from there is that Kenya will see growth this year. I think that's a very positive, encouraging story. It actually set up a great backdrop for the meetings that our clients had with the corporates, because certainly if you're investing, as you can imagine, in East African firms or particularly in Kenyan firms, you want to hear that there's growth coming out on the macro side. And so that was really encouraging to hear.
Okay, very well, guys. Thank you very much for a very interesting session, Charles and Yvonne. We at the Kenyan Wall Street were very happy to have you on this podcast, and we hope that our audiences also enjoyed the conversation. Thank you guys so much. Could you share with our audiences how they can get in touch with you, either via social media or how can they follow up the discussion with you or check out some of the work that RenCap is doing?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I do tweet quite a lot. So at RenCapMan is always, a forum to engage with me, as well as our office in Nairobi as well.
Mm-hmm. Yvonne?
Also on Twitter, if I remember correctly, my handle is at Yvonne Mohango. So, yes, I'm accessible, not as active as Charlie, but I will respond to messages via Twitter.
Okay, thank you guys. And you can also follow us at Kenyan Wall Street on Twitter. And you can also get in touch with me at Prince_Muraguri. So thank you guys. It was a lovely session. Stay safe, everyone. And see you on the next podcast. Bye.